Good evening. It's a great pleasure to be here, partly because I've been looking for an excuse to come and visit this very famous new Catholic college, Wyoming Catholic College, for some time. So when I got the invitation, I jumped at it so I could explore, and I've been exploring today, and I'm very impressed with what I see. But far more important than that, it's very unusual for me to be introduced by somebody who doesn't have an accent. So our topic tonight, as was mentioned, is the quest for Shakespeare, the Bard of Avon, and the Church of Rome. And I wanted to commence by stating that I was very much a skeptic against the theory that Shakespeare was a Catholic. I remember when I first came to the United States to teach at Ave Maria College, as it was then called, and it was then in Michigan. Back in 2001, one of my colleagues in the literature department there was a great believer in the Catholic Shakespeare. And my attitude was, you know, that's just wishful thinking. You know, there's not enough evidence. We don't know enough about Shakespeare as a man, as a person, to form any real understanding of what his religious and political beliefs were. So the only honest position, academically and intellectually, is to remain neutral and agnostic on the subject. However, the analogy I have is of a jigsaw puzzle. You know, if you have a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle and you've just got 5 or 6 pieces laid out in front of you, there's no way at all that you can get a picture. You can know what the final picture is going to be. But as more pieces emerge, you know, you begin to think, well, hold on a second, this looks like a landscape. You know, and then that's a tree and that's a barn. And even if you only have half the pieces, if you have half the pieces, you're pretty sure of what the picture is, even if you don't have all the detail. And this really is the situation with the life of Shakespeare and the evidence that kept presenting itself to me over the past 8 or 9 years. So I began as a skeptic, and then, you know, I'd read something giving evidence for Shakespeare's Catholicism, either from his plays or his poems or his sonnets or his life. And my eyebrows would raise. Well, that's interesting, but still ultimately unconvincing. And then I'd come across something else. And again, well, that's interesting. I'm still not convinced, but, you know, but there's that. And there comes a point, a threshold point, if you like, where you think, this is worth investigating. This is worth checking out. And at that point was when I actually began my own concerted effort to look at the evidence for Shakespeare's Catholicism, to see what evidence there was, to see whether it was indeed just wishful thinking or whether we can, from the evidence we have, come to a definite conclusion as regards whether or not Shakespeare is a Catholic. And then the next thing I realized, there are two ways of looking for evidence for Shakespeare's Catholicism. One is in the facts of his life. The other is in the text of his works. And they're both legitimate. However, in the postmodern deconstructionist age in which we live, it's become very fashionable in the radical relativism of the academy to read a text and have it reflect back to you narcissistically whatever you want to see in it. Thus, for instance, that Shakespeare is all things to all men now. To queer theorists, he's a homosexual. To feminists, he's a feminist. To feminists who hate men, he's a male chauvinist pig. So what I didn't want to do is to, you know, give all this evidence for Shakespeare's Catholicism from the text of his works, only to be told, Well, you would say that, wouldn't you? You're a Catholic. So I thought that the first thing we need to do is to have the evidence from his life, from documentary evidence, from facts that are irrefutable. So the first of my books, The Quest for Shakespeare, the one that was published last year, rather providentially, as far as I'm concerned, on Shakespeare's birthday, April the 23rd, St. George's Day, 2008. That looks at the evidence for Shakespeare's Catholicism in his life. The next book, which is published next month, I believe, is called Through Shakespeare's Eyes, Seeing the Catholic Presence in the Plays. And I decided then that, I'm not going to mention any names, but other people who have done work on the Catholic Shakespeare, one of the big mistakes they make is to pluck one line from this play, one line from that play, one line from that sonnet, and put it all together and say this is evidence for Shakespeare's Catholicism. And that's not very convincing, because, you know, if you pluck this line from a play and say this is evidence for Shakespeare's Catholicism, someone who knows the play can say, well, that's fine, that's in Act 2, but in Act 4, you know, so-and-so says this, which surely throws that into question. So I decided what we had to do was to look at the plays methodically. So initially I had this idea of, you know, one chapter per play, you know, 15 chapters, 15 plays, great, and do another book later and cover the rest. But I realized that you have to work through these plays scene by scene. So you look at the play itself in its entirety as an integral whole. If you want to show and prove what the play is saying. So that's why my second book is just those three plays that were mentioned, Merchant of Venice, Hamlet, and King Lear. I now realize the rather daunting task ahead of me that I have to write another 14 books. So if God allows me to live until I'm 117, it's a task I intend to bring to full fruition. However, tonight, although I'll happily do my best to answer questions on the textual evidence when we get there, in the time we have available, I'm going to be speaking about the evidence in his life. And I say that has to come first, because if you can show all the evidence in his life suggests strongly that Shakespeare was a Catholic, then it's very legitimate to say, well, if he's a Catholic, if all the evidence from his life, all the documentary biographical evidence suggests Shakespeare's Catholicism, then we would expect to see that Catholicism in the plays. Do we see that Catholicism in the plays? Yes, we do. So that's the logical way. And then the two come together like a Gothic arch, whereas the biographical evidence and the textual evidence together support each other and make a pretty watertight case. And this, by the way, is incredibly controversial. I've been attacked far more for writing this book than any other book I've written, I'm delighted to say. Because it shows it's hitting home. So let's look at the evidence. We'll start at the beginning with Shakespeare's family. Shakespeare's mother's family, the Ardens, were one of the most notorious Catholic recusant families in the whole of England. Now let's define our terms before we go any further. In Elizabeth's England, where it was illegal to be a Catholic and where to be a Catholic priest was punishable by death, to harbour a Catholic priest was punishable by death. St. Mary Clitheroe, possibly pregnant at the time, was crushed to death, with weights being put on her chest until her rib cage collapsed. Her crime was harboring a Catholic priest. So this was the culture in which Shakespeare was born. And in England, the Reformation wasn't the Reformation, in the sense that in Europe, the Reformation was about ideas. It was about theology, the ideas of Martin Luther and Calvin and the Catholic Counter-Reformation. In England, it was about Henry VIII wanting a divorce. And it was basically a Machiavellian move by Henry VIII to get what he wants, to announce himself as head of the church in England, to buy off most of the rich aristocracy in England by offering them thousands of acres of land that belonged to the church in forms of monasteries and abbeys and churches in return for their support for this move. So it was a Machiavellian move, not based upon ideas at all. And as historians such as Eamon Duffy have shown, it was very unpopular with the people of England. England was a happily Catholic country where Puritanism and Protestantism, Calvinism, Lutheranism had not really taken hold at all. So you had a population that was resentful of this new state religion. But it was mandated in law that you had to attend the state religion's churches, services. Of course, you couldn't attend Catholic services because they were outlawed, banned. So in England, the Catholic population fell into three distinct groups. What we might call the church conformists. And these were Catholics who went to the Anglican services in order to avoid paying the fines, but mumbled and grumbled amongst themselves, hoping and wishing and praying for a return of the good old days. Now, these people lost their faith within a generation or two. The second group are what have become known as the church papists. The term papist is a term of abuse for Catholics that Protestants used. You know, one who follows the Pope is a papist. The church papists were those who went to the Anglican services to avoid paying the fines, but secretly also went to Catholic Mass and confession whenever there was an undercover priest in the neighborhood. So they lived a double life, outwardly conforming, secretly non-conforming. And then the third group were the recusants. The recusants were the devout, if you like, militant Catholics who refused to attend Anglican services and were fined in consequence. Shakespeare's mother's family was one of the most notorious recusant families in England. So Shakespeare just didn't come from a Catholic family. He came from one on his mother's side, one of the most notorious Catholic families in England. Several of Shakespeare's cousins were executed for their involvement in so-called papist plots. So what about his father? Well, his father, John Shakespeare, is rather interesting. In 1592, which is when Shakespeare is in London, writing his plays, making a name for himself, John Shakespeare is fined for being a recusant Catholic. Again, we're talking about documents here, court records. Fined for being a recusant Catholic. Another very intriguing thing, it's exciting getting involved in this Shakespeare stuff because it's like being a detective. About in the 1700s, about 150 years after Shakespeare died, a builder was working on the Shakespeare family home in Stratford-upon-Avon and discovered a document hidden in the rafters of the roof, between the rafter and the roof itself, a document. And this document was John Shakespeare's spiritual last will and testament. And it's not like a legal last will and testament where you're talking about leaving money and property to whomever. It was basically saying, I, John Shakespeare, am a Catholic. I regret any murmuration against the church, etc., etc. And perhaps most significantly, I, John Shakespeare, as a Catholic and a believer in the Holy Roman Catholic Church, desire on my deathbed to have the ministrations of a Catholic priest to receive the last rites of the church. And if this is not possible, I hereby declare in this last will and testament my most earnest and solemn desire that this should be the case. Now, this is a very curious document to be discovered 150 years after Shakespeare's death. But it gets more and more curious. There was a scholar, Father Herbert Thurston, in the early part of this 20th century, 100 years or so ago, who discovered a document in Mexico, in Spanish, with almost exactly the same wording as this document that was signed by John Shakespeare. That's what on earth connects Stratford-upon-Avon, Shakespeare, and Mexico? The plot thickens. And then they discover another document in Spanish in Spain. Exactly the same wording. And finally, they found a document in Switzerland in the Romance language. The same wording. Curiouser and curiouser. What's the connection? Well, it's obvious, really. Think about it. Shakespeare, Mexico, Switzerland, Spain. Obvious. You'd obviously already guessed that the connection was St. Charles Borromeo in Italy. Yes? Well, let me explain. St. Charles Borromeo was the Archbishop of Milan in the late 1500s, contemporary of Shakespeare, much older, he's an old man. And in the 1570s, there was a major plague in Milan. And tens of thousands of Milanese were dying. So St. Charles Borromeo, as a good pastor of his flock, wrote a spiritual last will and testament to be handed out around Milan so that people could sign it, so that if there was not a priest available when they were dying of the plague, it's what you might call an extreme unction by desire. Of desire, we have, we know of the baptism of desire. Well, this is, you know, the last rites of desire. If there's no priest, this is to declare that I wish that there were one. Now, what has that to do with William Shakespeare's father? Well, the people in England actually were suffering a very similar problem. Not the plague, although actually in the year Shakespeare was born, there was a plague in Stratford-upon-Avon that took away a significant portion of the population. And if young William had been one of them, we'd have been so much the poorer in Western civilization. But that wasn't the reason. Of course, in England, there was a chance you wouldn't have a priest available when you died because priests were illegal. And the priests that were wandering around the country were few in number and disguised. And you had no way of knowing there would be a priest in your neighborhood when you were about to die. So there was the same need. So how do these documents find themselves in England, in Stratford-upon-Avon? Well, we know, again, all wonderful documentary evidence, that the English, mostly Jesuits, but the English missionary priests on their way to England, to almost certain death, these martyrs, on their way from Rome, stopped and stayed with St. Charles Borromeo in Milan. We have documents, for instance, of St. Edmund Campion, whose feast day was last week, and his companions staying as the guests of St. Charles Borromeo in Milan en route. Now, those of you that know your European geography know that if you travel overland from Rome to England, you head north, and after, I think, 250, 300 miles or something, you come to Milan. So this is on the way. They stayed there. We know other subsequent groups also stayed with the elderly St. Charles Borromeo. This is 1580, by the way, when St. Edmund Campion came over. The plague was in the 1570s, so very recently. We also then have a document from a priest in England writing to his superior in Rome requesting more copies of the testaments because many people desire them in England. Now, it was often thought this must refer to the new Douay translation of the New Testament. But there were two problems with that. One made it unlikely, and the other one made it impossible. The unlikely one was these priests are coming, are being smuggled into England in plain clothes to get past the port authorities. Is it likely that priests coming to England, almost definitely facing certain death, if caught, are going to be carrying around heavy, bulky, and very expensive new editions of the Douay-Rheims translation of the New Testament. Unlikely, because impractical. But it's also impossible, because the date of this letter requesting more copies of the Testaments, because many people desire them, is 1 month before the first edition of the Douay-Rheims translation was published. So clearly it cannot be the New Testament. So logic would suggest that this spiritual last will and testament that we found in the rafters, the Borromeo one, it's only a few pages long, easily hidden, easily printed, is quite clearly that's the way that it came in. So Shakespeare's father is a recusant Catholic, fined for his Catholicism, hiding this document in his roof. And God knows what fear came upon him to do that, to hide it in his roof. Clearly, either the Shakespeare home had been raided during after the Somerville plot or some of these other so-called plots, where we know that many of Shakespeare's friends' houses were raided in anti-Catholic raids. Either the Shakespeare home was raided, or John Shakespeare was sufficiently fearful that the house would be raided to hide the spiritual will and testament in the rafters of the house where it remained for 150 years after William's death. Okay, his mother's a recusant Catholic, his father's a recusant Catholic. We know in my book, there's a chapter called A Rose by Any Other Name, looking at the evidence for Shakespeare being a schoolmaster in the country at Holkham Hall in Lancashire near Preston at the same time that St. Edmund Campion was in the area. Now, modern biographers such as Stephen Greenblatt put a lot of credibility on this. It would take me 10 or 15 minutes to give the evidence. I'm not skeptical, but I say that we can't know. It's not one of the strongest cases for Shakespeare's Catholicism that he was in this staunchly Catholic household. He may have been, but we don't know. So I'm going to move on from that. But Shakespeare leaves Stratford-upon-Avon in a hurry. We know that. And he comes to London, and we know that. He arrives sometime in the mid to late 1580s. We know that, and he stays until around 1610, 1612, and then returns home to Stratford-upon-Avon. So he's in London for about 25 years or so. We know that. None of that's really in dispute. What the secular scholars are now saying, they've sort of been forced to accept that Shakespeare grew up in a staunchly Catholic family at a time of gross persecution of Catholics. But what they say is that he came to London, lost his faith, conveniently for them, about the time he starts writing his plays. And then they could just sort of dismiss the Catholicism as, look, you know, he's looking back upon an old, dying past that he's grown out of, rejected, and moved on from. Perfect, because then they can just look upon Catholicism as something old and superstitious. Perfect reflection, in fact, of the postmodern critic's view, conveniently. However, what is the evidence? What evidence do we have? And again, this is what I used to think, well, we don't really know much about Shakespeare's life in London. So we don't know, we can't know. But we actually know a great deal more about Shakespeare's life in London than most people realize. And I'll talk about documentary evidence. So let's look at some of this. First of all, Shakespeare never attended the local parish church in Southwark, just south of the River Thames, where we know he was living in the last years of the 1590s. Because we have the register, you know, the parish records, and you look through, and scholars have poured through over and over again looking for evidence of Shakespeare's attendance there. Many of Shakespeare's acting friends that had been found there, but not Shakespeare. Of course, this is seen as evidence by the secular scholars of Shakespeare being a good agnostic or atheist. He never attended church. Well, let's look at the logic. His father never attended church either, nor did his mother. And it wasn't because they were agnostics or atheists. Isn't it far more logical that Shakespeare never attended church for the same reason that his parents didn't attend church? Because in conscience, as a believing, a devout Catholic, he could not attend the state religion which was putting Catholics to death. That has to be the logical position. Not least, by the way, because in 1606, also when Shakespeare is in the midst of writing his plays, his daughter, Susanna, is also fined for being a recusant Catholic. So his parents and his children don't go to church because they're Catholics. Shakespeare doesn't go to church because he's an atheist. Does not figure. Now, why, we wonder, though, is there no evidence for Shakespeare being fined for his recusancy? This is a very interesting point. And in my book, I look at the example of William Byrd. Now, you have a wonderful choir here, by the way. I had the honor of listening to you during Mass today. I'm sure, at least I hope, that at some stage you do actually sing some William Byrd. William Byrd, one of the great composers of Catholic polyphony, Gentleman of the Chapel Royal, contemporary of Shakespeare, older, but alive at the same time. He was Queen Elizabeth's favorite composer. He was also a recusant Catholic. Now, we know this because he was fined. And there are records to show that he was fined, and his wife was fined. And at some point, the Attorney General, the Queen's chief lawyer, told the authorities to leave William Byrd alone. And thereafter, he continued to be a recusant Catholic. He continued to compose music for the Queen and secretly to compose these wonderful Catholic motets and the Mass for three voices, etc., for the Catholic liturgy. So we know from the case of William Byrd that if the Catholic was seen not to be a threat to Her Majesty, and if Her Majesty liked that person, a blind eye would be turned to their non-attendance to Anglican services. Of course, they were expected to be discreet about their Catholicism, otherwise they'd be in big trouble. And of course, Shakespeare certainly was. So that parallel, I think, is very, very telling, because it's a situation we actually know about. We also know, by the way, because we have to understand history. We get this vision, you see Jesuit priests being put to death, being hanged, drawn, and quartered. Women, wives and mothers being crushed to death for harboring priests. And we have this picture in our mind, you know, every single Catholic is desperately hiding away in caves and keeping themselves secret. But there were known Catholics in Queen Elizabeth's court. So much so that the actual Catholic Church drew up a list of rules that people, Catholics that were in the Queen's train, what they could and couldn't do. So for instance, they could attend Anglican services only if they were in the Queen's train, in other words, as part of their service to the Queen, but they were not allowed to receive communion. So there were known Catholics literally in the Queen's court. One of the best known being the Earl of Southampton, Shakespeare's first and major patron in the early days. We know about the Earl of Southampton, by the way. I can't give you, there's not enough time to give you too much of his life story. But he came again from one of the most militantly recusant Catholic families. When his father died, he was taken away from his mother for large parts of time, brought to court, and a Protestant anti-Catholic Italian tutor was taught him to teach him to not be a Catholic any longer. But when he went home to his mother, there was a Catholic tutor who taught him Catholicism. So he was being ripped apart. But where did he stand? Well, we know from the evidence of a priest being tortured that in the early 1590s, which is exactly when he was Shakespeare's patron, the Earl of Southampton was not only a practicing Catholic, but had the Jesuit martyr, St. Robert Southwell, as his confessor. St. Robert Southwell would be arrested in 1592, would be tortured repeatedly for 3 years, and would be hanged, drawn, and quartered in 1595. 33 years old, the same age as our Lord, when he died. A wonderful poet. Don't have time here, but there's a lot of textual evidence of St. Robert Southwell addressing his poetry to William Shakespeare and to the Earl of Southampton, and there's evidence for Shakespeare responding to St. Robert Southwell. St. Robert Southwell's volume of poetry was dedicated to Mr. W.S., my worthy cousin. St. Robert Southwell and William Shakespeare were distantly related as cousins. Mr. W.S., is that William Shakespeare? It's interesting, however, that in the first edition of St. Robert Southwell's poetry, that dedication does not appear. The first time that dedication appears is the edition that appears in 1616, which is significant as the date of Shakespeare's death. First of all, one would suspect that it's tribute to Shakespeare by the printer, knowing the relationship between St. Robert Southwell and Shakespeare, and also being 1616, could not possibly do Shakespeare any harm. Now, when a known traitor who's just been executed for treason in the eyes of the state dedicates his poetry to you, it's a bit of a dangerous gift. So the fact that a name doesn't appear till 1616, when Shakespeare is safely dead, tends to reinforce the suspicion that indeed that the dedication is to him. Also, again, no time now, but in my second book, coming out next month, I go at some length looking at the evidence from the Merchant of Venice for allusions to Robert Southwell's martyrdom, where Shakespeare is quoting lines from Southwell's poems in very, very telling ways. So Shakespeare's benefactor, the Earl of Southampton, was, at the time he was Shakespeare's benefactor, a practicing Catholic who had a Jesuit martyr as his confessor. Almost definitely Shakespeare knew St. Robert Southwell well himself. Okay, there's a court case, this documentary evidence, a court case in London where Shakespeare is accused of threatening to kill someone. And what's interesting, Shakespeare and several other co-defendants are accused of threatening to kill these two plaintiffs. Now, what's interesting, we don't know what happened to make this court case happen, but the interesting thing is that amongst Shakespeare's co-defendants are two known Catholic recusants. The two plaintiffs accusing him are known anti-Catholic persecutors of Catholics, who actually have in writing reports they wrote about the raiding of Catholic homes, the burning of crucifixes, the burning of Catholic books, and gloating about it. These are the people that accuse Shakespeare of threatening their life. So again, you tell an awful lot by someone's friends, two known recusant Catholics amongst the co-defendants with Shakespeare, two known anti-Catholics, those that are opposing him in court. Okay, but the strongest evidence for Shakespeare's Catholicism during his time in London is probably the last legal transaction, last legal act he makes, for which we have documentation, before he retires and returns to Stratford-upon-Avon. Shortly before he returns to Stratford, he buys the Blackfriars Gatehouse, a property, a large property in the middle of London. Those of you that have been to London will know there's a tube station, Blackfriars Tube Station, and Blackfriars Bridge over the River Thames. But obviously Blackfriars comes from the Dominicans. It was the Dominican religious house in the middle of London. Henry VIII dissolves it, and that ceases to exist in the 1530s. But why is it significant? If you read secular biographers of Shakespeare, it was clearly an investment. A financial investment. Well, that's interesting because Shakespeare by this time had been living in London for 25 years and had never shown any particular interest in investing in property at all, not even in one for him to live in himself. As he'd lived in rented accommodation, so it seems, for the entire 25 years. The only house he'd ever bought was the second largest house in Stratford-upon-Avon for his family, the house to which he would retire. So why suddenly become interested in investing in property when he'd never been interested before? Well, let's look at this house. From the time of the dissolution of the monasteries in the 1530s until the time Shakespeare buys it, I think in 1612, so for a space of 80 years, the house had remained, and of course you can tell all this by property deeds, all this is traceable through documentary evidence. The house remains in Catholic hands. Not only does it remain in Catholic hands, it becomes one of the most notorious houses in London for secret, clandestine, recusant activity. There are reports, government reports of the house being raided, in which the report says there are secret passageways leading down to the River Thames so that people can make quick getaways. We know from correspondence from Rome that priests hid there in that house. One of the most notorious Catholic priests who was alleged to have been involved with the gunpowder plot, Father Henry Garnet, Jesuit, was known to have knocked on the door in disguise, running away from the authorities, begging to be allowed to stay there. This is the house that Shakespeare buys. Interestingly as well, not only does he buy this house, he insists, as part of the legal agreement, that the person who lived in the house before he bought it should be allowed to remain living in the house now after he's bought it. In other words, that the house was going to be used in exactly the same way now that Shakespeare owned it as it had been used in previous years. And we already know how it was used in previous years. The person whose name was on the property deed as being allowed to continue living there as the tenant was someone called John Robinson. In the same year in which Shakespeare buys this house, John Robinson's brother enters the English College in Rome to study for the priesthood. Of Shakespeare's London friends, the only one who is present during his final illness and who signs his will is the same John Robinson. So, do we have evidence for Shakespeare's Catholicism? Purely from documentary evidence, without looking at the plays? Well, yes, we do, and plenty of it. Let's look at the last piece of documentary evidence, his will. Shakespeare's last will and testament, not his spiritual last will, the real thing. Who does he leave his money to? Well, first of all, the chief executress of his will is Susanna Shakespeare, his daughter who was fined for her recusancy 10 years earlier, and not the other daughter, Judith, who'd married a Protestant. She got considerably less money. Also, there were some close members of Shakespeare's family, related to his mother, who in the hierarchy of blood, if you like, of blood relatives, should have got a significant portion of Shakespeare's will, and they were left out completely. And that's because the husband had become the church warden at the local parish church, Anglican, Protestant. He receives no money at all. However, many of local residents of Stratford-upon-Avon, who had been friends of Shakespeare all through his life, were quite healthy beneficiaries of the will. These people were all local known recusant Catholics. So Shakespeare, clearly, the friends from his childhood, when he was growing up Catholic, were still his friends when he died, and they were beneficiaries of his will. And they were known recusant Catholics. So, you put all this evidence together. All right, we don't have every single piece of the jigsaw puzzle, but we have enough of the jigsaw puzzle to see what the picture is. to know, as we would say in a court of law, beyond all reasonable doubt, that Shakespeare was a Catholic, not only growing up as a child, but remained a Catholic while he was writing his plays, buys a notorious Catholic house just as he's retiring to Stratford, leaves most of his money to known Catholics when he dies. Remains a Catholic throughout the whole of his life. So then we move on. Well, would we expect to find this Catholicism in his plays? Yes, we would. Do we? Yes, we do. Now I'm going to conclude the talk with something which shouldn't really be necessary at a highbrow institution like this. And I'll conclude just in case there's anybody here that doesn't qualify as highbrow. And that's that, you know, we'd be tempted to think, at least some people might be tempted to think, well, isn't this just academic in the worst sense of that word, i.e. irrelevant? I mean, who cares? Well, let me tell you how important this is. Let me give you a practical example. When the Lord of the Rings movies came out in 2001, I was fortunate, or I might like to think providence was shining on me, because I had two books on Shakespeare, on Tolkien, already published. Within a year of the first Peter Jackson film coming out, there was a plethora of new books on Tolkien, but I was there already. So consequently, in the months after the first film was published, I was received speaking engagements from all over the country to give a talk on Unlocking the Lord of the Rings. And I spoke at state universities in various parts of the country, Ivy League schools, spoke at Harvard and Princeton and Columbia, Washington and Lee, and say some big state universities. And there would often be 300 students attending a talk on Unlocking the Lord of the Rings. What they would get for the next 45 minutes was unadulterated Catholic theology. When you unlock the Lord of the Rings, that's what you get. I'll give you just a quick example. I think we have time. This is relevant to Shakespeare, by the way. I haven't gone off completely on a tangent. I will bring it back. But I'd say, you know, on what date was the ring destroyed to this large secular or Ivy League gathering? March the 25th. Well, March the 25th. What's the significance of March the 25th? Well, what happened 9 months after March the 25th? April, May, June, July, August. December 25th. Santa Claus comes. Actually, even in Ivy League schools, they're not quite that ignorant. Jesus was born. Okay, so what happened 9 months before that? The Archangel Gabriel agrees. Why is that important? Well, because that's the date when the Word is made flesh, when God becomes man. Because, of course, remember, secular school, Ivy League school, life doesn't begin at birth, it begins at conception. Therefore, March the 25th is a more important feast day than December 25th, which is why the medievals believed that March the 25th was also the date of the crucifixion. In fact, there's evidence that goes right back to the fathers, but that's another matter. So the Fellowship of the Ring leaves Rivendell on December the 25th, and Frodo and Sam arrive at Mount Doom on March the 25th. It's the life of Christ. So anyway, 300 people sit there. Now, at Columbia University, half of the Science Fiction Society walked out on me. But the other half stayed, and one or two of those lined up very patiently and asked some very intelligent questions. But 300 or more students at various places sat for the most part spellbound as Catholic theology was unraveled to them. Now, what if at the same university someone had gone to speak on unlocking the gospel? Instead of there being 300 people there, there'd be maybe 30 people there, of whom 25 were already firm Christian believers who wanted some reassurance. And maybe 5 were genuinely interested in finding out more. Well, it'd be worth giving the talk for that alone. But here we have 300. And this is the power to evangelize our culture. We live in a radical relativist culture. And in a radical relativist culture, which believes that truth, as Shakespeare puts into the words of Polonius, this above all, to thine own self be true, which actually was, believe it or not, my school motto. This above all, to thine own self be true, which I then practiced and became a militant neo-Nazi racist. And in theory, no one could condemn me from a relativistic perspective because I was being true to myself. However, of course, Shakespeare makes Polonius a complete buffoon and idiot whose advice gets his son killed, drives his daughter mad, and gets himself killed. So we know what Shakespeare thinks about radical relativism. But in the radical relativistic world in which we live, you can't engage people through philosophy. Because, oh, well, that's your truth. My truth is something different. There's no objective correlative to connect with. Nor can you connect with them theologically, because they're not interested in religion, they're not interested in scripture. But you can still connect to them through the power of beauty. And of course, beauty is never something that exists in isolation. Beauty is a conveyor of philosophical and theological truth, at least in the great works of Western civilization. So through the Lord of the Rings, you can reach 10 times more people. Now think about Shakespeare. He's taught all over the world. He's abused abysmally. There should be a law against Shakespeare abuse. But if we can show definitively through evidence that Shakespeare was a believing Catholic, it forces Catholicism back onto the agenda at any academic institution around the world that's honest enough to look for the truth rather than merely want relativist propaganda. And that's a powerful, powerful force. So this is not just academic. This has great evangelical potential and power as well, which is why the Catholic Shakespeare is such a volatile issue and why I and others are being attacked for presenting this evidence. It's not what the secular academy wants to hear, but it's going to continue to hear it because it is the truth, and the truth can be factually demonstrated. So I want to finish with a toast. Unfortunately, I only have water, but I'll live with that. To William Shakespeare, the Catholic genius. Thank you. Thank you.